Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki, episode 114, recorded Thursday, September 29th, 2011. Into the Deep. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome, everyone, to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I am Dr. Kiki, and I hope you're ready to get down and dirty, to dig into the science, because today we're actually not just getting dirty, we're getting wet. We're going into the deep oceans. We're going to be talking about deep sea squid. And our guests today are Drs. Bruce Robison and Hendrik Hoving from Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. Looking forward to talking with them about a recent publication that they published regarding squid mating habits. And we'll use that as a jumping off point into a discussion of squid ecology, deep sea ocean ecology, and finding out what we know and what we're trying to find out about the deep oceans that we have a hard time seeing and a hard time visiting. But you know where it goes first? Science headlines before we get into the conversation. So, hey ladies, I hope you had your coffee this morning. It turns out that coffee might help with depression. According to a study involving more than 50,000 women, those who drank two or more cups of coffee a day were less likely to be diagnosed with depression. But how can you be depressed when there is news that one-third of suns like our own might harbor Earth-like planets? Wesley Traub from Caltech reported this optimistic number in Physics Archive based on his statistical analysis of the latest Kepler data. Tomorrow, September 30th, 2011, marks the closing of Fermilab's Tevatron Collider, which smashed atoms and records for over three decades to make way for the more powerful Large Hadron Collider at CERN. The final proton-antiproton collisions will happen tomorrow, but data analysis will continue for years. And we know there will be a lot of great discoveries coming from Fermilab for years to come. In more Fermilab news, physicists from the famed Particle Lab will be double-checking the CERN faster-than-light neutrino story from last week with data of their own from the MINOS experiment. The data analysis in this case will use even more sophisticated GPS, atomic clocks, and LED lighting than used by the CERN experiment, and it never hurts to add more data to get a better picture of something as tiny as a neutrino. China successfully launched its first inhabitable space station module into orbit on a Long March 2F launch vehicle. Tiangong 1, meaning Heavenly Palace, will remain in orbit for 2 years and receive three missions during that time. The third mission will be a manned mission, hopefully carrying China's first female taikonaut. NASA's UARS satellite fell back to Earth last weekend and didn't hit anybody. Thank goodness. NASA pinpointed the crash site as somewhere in an uninhabited stretch of the South Pacific Ocean. And that does it for the headlines this week. Without further ado, I'd like to thank Netflix for their support of this program. Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix today. Netflix streams thousands of TV shows and movies directly to your TV, directly to you instantly, which means that you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and shows on your Mac or PC, your iPad, your iPhone, even Android devices for those of you who are Android inclined. If you have a gaming console like a PS3 or an Xbox or a Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your television. If you're not a gamer, you can watch it with an Apple TV or a Roku box. They're pretty inexpensive and easy to use. With Netflix, you can watch these movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices. You can begin watching on one device, stop watching it, and then pick up later where you left off on any device of your choosing. And you can begin whichever way you choose to access Netflix. You can watch as many movies and TV shows as you like, and you can cancel at any time for free. Try Netflix today for 30 days for free. Go to netflix.com/twit. That's netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial. That's netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, and we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. All right, on to our conversation. It's time to bring in our guests. Today we're joined by two researchers from the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute after earning a BS from Purdue University and a master's in the arts from College of William and Mary. Bruce Robison returned home to California and Stanford University, where he completed a PhD in 1973. He spent 2 years conducting a postdoctoral research study in deep sea fishes at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution before accepting a position at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And in 1987, he joined the newly formed MBARI, Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, where he's presently a senior scientist. And Dr. Hendrik Hovink, Hank Jan is a postdoctoral researcher with Bruce Robison and received his PhD in ocean ecosystems from the University of Groningen with his thesis titled Reproductive Biology of Oceanic and Deep Sea Descapodiform Cephalopods. Thank you both for joining me. I really appreciate taking the time you're taking out of your day today.
You're very welcome.
Thanks. So the paper, let's jump off in this conversation with discussion of the paper that hit the news last week. Did you expect it to make such a, and I, this is not pun intended, big splash?
No. I did not foresee the amount of attention it received. We actually were all three authors of the paper were about to leave to see at the moment the paper was published. So that was basically standing on the docks and talking to reporters, which was
a little bit a change from your ordinary trip, right?
Yeah.
I think the question is where the interest came from and whether or not you can use it to educate people and get, I guess, greater interest in squids in general. So Hendrik, your interest in squid reproduction and this study, can you just tell us a little bit for people who maybe didn't hear the story to begin with? Tell us what the aim of the study was and then what your results you found.
Well, the interesting study, the interesting part of the study is that we found, first of all, the data that we used is unique because it's collected over since 1992 these animals have been recorded. These are solitary animals which are not often caught, but MBARI, the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, has this unique database where images and video of these deep sea animals, of all the deep sea animals that they encounter during their dives, are actually being recorded and annotated into a database. So this, first of all, is unique. And second, when going through all this video, we were able to, for this particular species, to differentiate between males and females squid. And then third, we were able to pick up evidence of mating And after doing so, through going through all the video and basically collecting information on these mating traces, we, to our surprise, found that both males and females were found to have sperm packages, so-called spermatangia, in their tissue.
What are the characteristics of these sperm packages? How do you notice whether or not an individual squid carries one of them on its appendages?
You can see them on the video as white dots. And we can show it if you show the video of Octoprotuthis. I can show you where they are. But they're visible on the animal as white dots.
As white dots, okay. Lynn, do you have that video? Octoprotuthis.
Number one. Nope. Right, so this is Octoprotuthis deletron, as we encounter them with the remotely operated vehicle.
It's a beautiful picture.
Yeah.
It's really clear. Got some good cameras.
HD.
Nice.
So the spermatangia are seen.
Can we go back and watch that again? So where do you see the spermatangia?
Or
do
yeah, this
you
is
see
a,
them here?
This is a different video, so.
So what we're seeing here is we have a really clear image of a squid.
Yeah, so you see the fins flapping. Yeah. And right on top of the body, just behind the fins, you can see these orangey whitish patches, and those are spermatangia.
Okay. It's a beautiful creature. So you have probably hours and hours of video of encounters with different squid. How much actual water time and vehicle time does that represent, like going out to actually look for squid?
When we were at sea last week, we made dive number 3,642 for the ROV Ventana. That's in about 20-odd years of diving in Monterey Bay. And certainly all those dives weren't for our research, but we have thousands and thousands of hours of observation time in deep water.
Yeah. In terms of the videos that you watched, how many encounters did you end up analyzing to be able to determine sex and whether or not they carried these sperm packets?
So there were a total of 110 individuals, 108 in the paper, but by now we've seen two more. So it's and of those, and that varied from just glimpses, very brief encounters of a squid just passing by, to long observations of up to an hour sometimes. We could differentiate between sexes in 40 animals, 39 actually, and of these 39, we found 19 animals mated, and so having sperm packages, and of these 19 animals, there were 9 females and 10 males.
Okay, and then all of them, so the conclusion from your study, or the results of your study, you're basically saying that these animals are going out, the males are going out and indiscriminately depositing their sperm because they don't run into each other all the time. And it's pretty obvious from the numbers that you're talking about that out of all of the individuals, it's a very small number that have had any kind of encounter to have a mating.
Yeah, but the reason why we could only... that we only found So we had 108 individuals, but mm-hmm. but some of the video was not completely suitable for analysis. So it's not that 19 of these 108 animals actually made it, but they were incorporated in our analysis. So, and from these equal numbers, we hypothesized and concluded that males indiscriminately mate with any animal of the same species that they encounter.
Yeah. Someone from the chat room is wondering whether or not you had to manually watch all the hours of the video encounters with the squid, or if you have some kind of an automated computer method.
We're there when the video is recorded. We're at sea watching the live video feed come up from the vehicle as it's being recorded. And then subsequently, the technicians in Mabari's video lab also analyze all of the video footage that's shot from the ROVs. And then we go back in and review it again for interesting information applied to different projects we're working on. So yes, human eyes watch that video many times. We as yet don't have a machine that'll do that for us, and frankly, I don't think we want one.
It's probably, and we were, go ahead.
Another good thing was that Stephanie Bush, our co-author on this paper, worked for a thesis on this species, so she went already through all the video and made notes, a lot of notes already about where spermatangia were actually seen in which animals. So that gave us a very good start for this study.
Yeah, in terms of what's happening with the sperm packets and the deposit of them, what exactly is a squid mating encounter like? What does it consist of? I don't know that many people would actually be familiar with the mating habits of the deep sea squid.
Well, that's a bit of a problem because nobody is actually very familiar with them, even us. So far, only for two species of deep sea squid have mating behavior being observed, and one of them is not even sure, because I spoke with the author of that paper and he said it could even be an event of cannibalism, so one eating the other. Reproductive behavior in deep sea squid is a topic very poorly known, and so even in our study we did not observe two animals mating. We basically found traces and evidence of mating, but we didn't see two individuals mating with each other.
Has anybody seen a deep sea squid mating encounter at any point in time, or is this still just inferred, like all of the information that you have, just you infer backwards?
Well, there's lots of baby squid out there, so they must be doing.
They're doing something right, obviously, but
we've never seen it.
Right. So, is in terms of studying an animal like the deep sea squid? I mean, you have your submersible vehicles. There are the vehicles you get in. There are the vehicles that are remotely operated. And you just have to go out and kind of know where you might find them, and then just hope for an interesting encounter. How does it work?
This was a discovery that we made while we were doing something else.
Okay. But
most of the good stuff that we find is not expected. We have projects that we work on that are long-term studies where we go out and gather data over time to look at the kinds of changes and that are taking place in the deep sea and the kinds of natural variability that occur there. But while we're doing that, we pay attention to what's going on. We see changes over time. We see differences that occur. And every once in a while, we'll come upon something that we've never seen before, whether it's a new animal or a new behavior pattern or a new interaction between species. And those are the sorts of discoveries that let us follow through and determine things like like we did in this recent paper. We didn't go out to study whether or not there was same-sex mating in Octopatuthis, but along the course of the other research we were conducting, this became evident, and we were able to follow through on it.
Yeah, what was the point? Was there a certain, just you looked at enough video, you're like, there's something going on here, we need to analyze this, we need to look at this statistically to see if it's actually in effect.
Right, and one of the great advantages we have working here at Mivari and using the assets that are available to us to explore deep water is that we become familiar with what's out there, who lives there, where they live relative to each other, how they usually interact. And so we're attuned to that habitat and can look at things and recognize when something is unique, something's different, something's interesting enough to follow up on.
Yeah, and in terms of studying the different species, so Octopatuthis is one species of this this deep sea squid. How many other species are you looking at in the water column, and do you think that you might find similar effects among different species if you were to go look for that for the similar mating habits?
Start with squids. How many species of squids?
How many number? Well, there.
Ballpark.
Around, like, say around 15 species that we see with ROV, and there may be many more out there that we don't see. Here in the Monterey Canyon alone, worldwide, there are hundreds of them. And squid, yeah, they measure from mature size, like several centimeters, to giant sizes of, like, giant squids, which weigh up to several hundreds of kilos. Here in the Monterey Canyon, we study squid from several different families, and... Yeah, I'm not sure if that answered your question.
For the different species, have you seen any evidence that suggests that that different species follow the similar kind of mating habit, where they just go out and go, I ran into somebody, that was awesome, here's some sperm, success. You know, is there more evidence for that, or is it completely unknown at this point?
No, that was the unique, basically, finding of this paper, that it has not been shown on this before. There were some indications that it might happen for squid, but those were, now we actually show for the first time and that it happens, and on a pretty frequent, actually, and we show it on animals that are in their natural habitats, and that makes the study unique. And this, so far, we have not seen any indication that it happens in other squid.
Have you looking at the different squid? Do you find that there are individuals that you run into repeatedly, like the same way that in larger organisms like whales or porpoises, that individuals are actually able to be identified and tracked over time? Is that something that's possible?
No.
Do they all look the same?
And the odds of encountering the same squid on two different dives are very, very small, because the habitat we're talking about is immense.
Yeah, it's the.
And even though there are only a relatively small number of squid of any given species down there, there still are so many of them that I think we probably could not encounter the same one twice. We've seen animals like Vampyrotuthis that we have noticed scars or injuries on. And when we go back and see other Vampirotuthas, we always look hoping that we'll recognize someone, but it's never happened.
It's never happened. So you mentioned a new squid name. We've moved on from the what was the first squid? The Octopatuthis. And now Vampirotuthis? Is it nothing to do with vampires, you think?
Well, the person who described it 100 years ago thought that it looked a little like a vampire.
Interesting. What's the difference in the habits of that squid, or the way that squid looks compared to the other one that we were just discussing?
Right. Well, we have some video footage of Vampirotuthis that you can put up. It's a fascinating animal. It's a real living fossil in many respects. It goes back at least 100 million years, almost unchanged. And it's not clear whether it's an ancestor of both the squids and octopuses, or whether it's closer to one than the other. But there's no question that it's an ancestor, a really ancient relict form of a living fossil. Now, they have, as you could see on that video footage, beautiful blue eyes.
Yeah, that, gorgeous.
That gather light in very dimly lit waters.
And the fins in the front look, I guess it's a bit like a vampire bat. It gives it that kind of look.
And that big web sort of looks like a cape.
Yeah.
Anyway, this one, as it turns out, has only one fin. We didn't put the footage of the damaged side up on the web, but I'd recognize that one again if we saw him, because he only has a fin on one side. And again, we look for him, but we've never seen them.
As you get, you mentioned that there are like multiple, the different species come in a range of different sizes. Do we find that as you know, larger species, are populations of fewer individuals, or is there no relation that you can find?
If you think about the Humboldt squid, which gets to be very large, there certainly appear to be many more of them than lots of the other smaller ones. I'd say the two in the last 5 to 10 years. The squids that we have seen most abundantly are the Humboldt squid, which is very big, and the Market squid, which is relatively small. So I don't think that size has much to do with abundance, at least not in this case.
In terms of individuals, we talk about there's a fascination in popular culture with the giant squid. And you know, there are anecdotal tales of whales being found with sucker marks that may have been from battles with the giant squid. Have you ever encountered a giant squid? And can you and even if not, can you talk about some of the reasons for the fascination that we have for this species?
We're fascinated too. It's not just the public.
Is it maybe your interest is different for a different reason maybe than the public's, or?
Well, maybe it started. I mean, I think for me it started as like for the general public, but then as you look more and more from a scientific point of view, it's a very interesting animal, and probably the most interesting thing is that they're so rarely caught or seen, and so you only can build a story of the animal, of its biology, you know, slowly, but very slowly. So, and one of your questions was if we've ever seen one. Well, we haven't seen one with the ROV before. The giant squid has only been recently, in 2005, observed for the first time alive in its habitat by Japanese scientists.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, it has not happened again. So that was a single time that it was put on video. on photographs, I think. I have seen them in museum collections, and they're very impressive. I mean, they're as big as the table that I'm sitting on now. They're huge, and you can only work on them if you have a crane. And so it's not very practical to work on them, but they're fascinating.
Yeah, and every chance if you get the chance, I'm sure that an encounter will give you all sorts of opportunity to view the squid if it ever happens. For the squid that you do find, you're having to observe them in their natural habitat. They're deep sea organisms. I've heard that there's a problem with bringing these organisms up to the surface level because of pressure problems. Is that one of the reasons that you want to observe them in their habitat, or is that just the way you like to do things?
No, absolutely. It's far more natural to observe the animals in their own habitat. And we try very much not only to make our observations there, but also to conduct research there. Any deep sea animal that you collect in deep water and bring to the surface for further research is being subjected to decompression. The pressure is very high in deep water, and if you bring them to the surface, even if you do it slowly, they're undergoing a physiological stress because of decompression, because of pressure change. And so at Mabari, we're very fortunate in that we have a large group of talented engineers to work with who let us design experimental devices, instrumentation, camera systems that let us take the laboratory into the ocean instead of bringing the animals out of the ocean and up into the lab. So there is a very significant advantage to being able to see these animals in their natural habitat. If you were exploring a forest or a desert, and all you knew about the animals that lived there were things that you'd observed or measurements that you'd taken on animals that you took back to the laboratory, you wouldn't have a very complete picture of how that all fit together into a natural situation.
Absolutely not. For as far as the practical issues of observing the animals, can you tell us a little bit about the vehicles that you're using and what kind of depths they're going to, what kind of pressures you're having to withstand, and how do you do your data collection?
Yes, we can talk.
Great.
There are a number of ways to go. Human-occupied vehicles are obviously carrying people inside them, and they give you a unique perspective that can't be matched. There's no substitute for being there yourself. However, robotic systems are able to be operated in circumstances where it's not safe to deploy manned systems. And as a consequence, there are many more robotic systems, ROVs, remotely operated vehicles, available. And indeed, Mabari has focused on robotic systems. So Mabari has two deep diving ROVs, Ventana, which will go down to 1,850 meters, and the Doc Ricketts, which will go down to 4,000 meters.
Wow.
They each have a dedicated mothership. They have high-definition video cameras and an array of lights, all sorts of instrumentation to measure the temperature, the pressure, the salinity, the oxygen concentration of the water around you. A wide range of collecting devices that let you pick things up off the bottom or pluck them out of the water column. We have ways of collecting things gently. We have ways of being a little firmer about animals that try to swim away. We use suction sampler that's like a big vacuum cleaner, and you can just crank up the dial on that. The vehicles are extremely versatile because of the variety of tools and instruments that we can use to configure them. We can trim them out to neutral buoyancy so they'll hover in the water column without having to thrust to hold them in place. They're extraordinary tools. From my point of view, it's not as good as being there yourself, but it's very close to having that advantage.
Yeah, in terms of comparisons, you're going to explore, you know, one of the great unknown areas of our own planet. Versus what are the challenges that you face versus, say, the challenges of people going to space to explore the unknowns around our planet? Do you think they're similar, or do you think they're substantially different? Do you think that going to greater pressures, going below the surface of the water, do you think that's a unique experience?
Well, I'm not sure if there are similar challenges. I think, I mean, if you drop something, it will fall down in space. It will flow up. But I think they're equally difficult environments to explore. And the good thing is here that we have that we can be in the deep sea within a couple of hours from a Bari. While we can't be within that reach and do the same thing in space. So I think it's a great opportunity to learn a lot from an environment that is equally poorly known as space, but is within our reach.
And the fundamental mechanical problem is similar. And it all relates to pressure. In space, you're trying to keep it in. And in the deep sea, you're trying to keep it out.
Right.
Similar problem, different sides of the issue.
Yeah. In terms of trying to get people more aware of what's going on with ocean ecology and issues related to that, what are the really, like, the most pressing or the most interesting questions to you about deep sea ecology?
We don't know how it works. The deep ocean is the largest living space on the planet. And not surprisingly, it's home to the largest animal communities on Earth. They play an enormous role in the cycling of carbon and nutrients and all of the natural energy flux on the planet. And yet, fundamentally, we still don't understand how it works. So if we're going to continue to live on this planet in harmony with our environment, we should at least have a good understanding of how the rest of the system works, because it's very clear that changes are taking place in the ocean and in the deep sea. But we, as yet, don't know enough to show the consequences of those changes. We don't have a baseline yet against which we can compare the consequences of rising temperatures or rising acidity or decreasing oxygen or decreasing productivity. All things that are going on, regardless of how they're caused. But if we don't understand the impacts of those kinds of changes on this enormous ecosystem, then we really can't say much with regard to what the world is going to be like down the road a few years.
Yeah, and part of the study of the different organisms in the water column, I've heard it said that, I think it was a story on NPR a year or so ago, that if we don't take care of our fisheries and the ecosystems, we're all going to end up eating jellyfish at some point. But how realistic do you think that is?
Well, we're definitely fishing what's so-called fishing down the food chain. So we're fishing at higher and higher trophic levels. So, I mean, an example here is that locally, Humboldt squid were mentioned earlier on, and there was actually in 2007, and before that, there was an incredible increase of these big squid in this area, which was correlated by the over-exploitation of big commercial fish like tuna and swordfish. So there's actually particular animals have the capacity to fill in the spaces that were left by overfished commercial fish. And this is a shift in food webs that are caused by humans, and this is sort of where the jellyfish story starts. And if we keep on doing this, then we end up eating jellyfish because there are no higher trophic levels left.
Yeah,
animals that reproduce quickly are opportunistic, and if you remove species from a food chain, species that perhaps have long generation times and long lifespans, chances are their niches are going to be filled by species that reproduce quickly and can move in opportunistically and take over. That's what Hank Yon was saying about both squids and jellyfishes. So I think you could safely say that if we continue to remove critical levels of the food chain by commercial exploitation or other kinds of influences, then we're going to see animals that can move opportunistically into those ecological niches, animals like jellies and squid, and change the whole structure of the system.
Which would not necessarily be great for mankind. So it's always a good idea to, as you said earlier, get an idea of what the system is so that we know if we're pushing on a certain lever, what the action and reaction will be. We're coming to the end of the hour here, and I'm just curious for both of you, what big question would you like to see approached and I guess really addressed in deep sea research in the next few years? What is a big thing that you really think should be covered?
I would like to see more scientific interest and attention to actually the big space between the upper 200 meters and the bottom of the ocean. A lot of deep sea research is going on still on the bottom of the ocean, while there's a huge food web actually present in the middle of the water column, which is very important for the global carbon cycle. This is the so-called pelagic habitat of part of the ocean, and I would like to see more research into that area.
I have three or four things I'd like to see back. If I'm limited to one, I would say we really need to understand the role of gelatinous animals much better. One of the biggest discoveries we've made in the last decade or so is that as we began to go into the deep ocean habitat for the first time and see with our own eyes, we realized that the things that we thought we knew based on dragging nets through the water were biased. They were true, but they were biased towards the animals that you can collect in nets, fishes and squids and hard-bodied crustaceans and things like that. What we weren't seeing from our net tows are the gelatinous animals, the soft-bodied, fragile things that in many respects are dominant creatures in the deep ocean water column, the area that Hank Yon was saying we need to explore. I really would like to understand how those animals fit into the overall structure of those deep ocean ecosystems. We guess that before we started diving into deep water and seeing things again with our own eyes, that we had underestimated the total biomass of the oceanic water column by about a third. We'd missed that much. That's a very significant number of animals, whether in terms of biomass or number of individuals or number of species. That's a huge gap in our understanding about how those ecosystems work. And I think there are a great many wonderful puzzles there to solve, all of which will help us to understand the whole system much better than we do.
Yeah, that's an amazing number to go from to find that you don't know about a third of the oceans. So the biomass, the individuals, what kind of influence do they have on the bigger system? How do they fit in? That's a big question. It's great, and I'd love to find out about your second, third, and fourth choices as well at some point. But we are coming to the end of the hour. I really want to say thank you so much to both of you for joining me today. It's been really interesting to find out more about squids. Is it? And do you refer to them as squid, plural squids? Is there a difference in the way that it's referred?
He's the expert.
It's like fish versus fishes, depending on if you're talking about a group of fish or multiple fish species is fishes, right?
Yep,
right.
Yeah.
So it's the same as in squid or squid.
Same for squids.
Right.
All right. So as we hopefully will learn much more about the many squid species that are out there. And if you find out anything else reproductively or otherwise, I'd love to be able to talk with you again and to learn more, because this is finding out more about part of the world that, you know, few people get to see, get to be able to come close to is, just a wonderful thing. So it's just great to have you here to share information about it. Is there any way that, that people can find out more about the research that you're working on or other people from the Institute? Is there a specific place that you'd like to send people?
Well, there's the Mabari webpage, and our colleague, Stephanie Bush, who is also a co-author on this paper, has a webpage at the University of Rhode Island where she now works. Also, there is a Mabari webpage on YouTube that has a variety of different video sequences that have been shot from the ROVs.
Great. So mbari.org is the website, and also YouTube is a great resource for finding all sorts of stuff. There are lots of research institutions and academics posting stuff to the web these days, and so I think it's just great to go out and search. So thank you once again for joining us and for all the information about deep sea squid. And we didn't get to as many of the videos or images as I hoped, but they are there for people to search for. There's a wonderful YouTube video from Mbari that you can take a look at. And I'm Dr. Kiki. This has been the Science Hour, and next week we're going to be talking about chemistry and life with Dr. Lee Cronin. Until then, you can follow my sciencey pursuits via the web. I'm Dr. Kiki on Twitter and Facebook, and Kiki Sanford on Google+, because they don't believe in doctors. And if you need more sciencey episodes, more sciencey goodness, you can head to twit.tv/Kiki, where past episodes of this show are available, and you can subscribe via iTunes or via the website. I will see you next week. Remember, all I ask is 1 hour a week, and I hope that this 1 hour makes your world a whole lot more interesting. Until then, here is my science meditation for the week. That's where the black-finned sharks are trying to eat a school fish.